Welcome to the 58th episode of the Jewish Drinking Show. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan, and I'm very excited to welcome first-time guest Professor Michael Satlow to the show.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So Professor Satlow here is Professor of Judaic Studies and Religious Studies at Brown University. He holds a PhD from JTS. What's your dissertation on?
It was on rabbinic rhetorics of sexuality.
Oh, Tasting the Dish, right. And then is the author of Creating Judaism, History, Tradition, and Practice, and How the Bible Became Holy. And also a book that made a cameo in the 55th episode is his Jewish Marriage in Antiquity. He also, this brings us more to the topic at hand for our episode. He published a commentary to the Book of Ben Sira for the recently released Jewish Annotated Apocrypha, edited by Jonathan Clawins and Lawrence Willis out of Oxford University. So that's what brings us to our topic, which is the Book of Ben Sira. Ben Sira is not, first of all, it's not a biblical book, and certainly not a rabbinic book exactly, although the rabbis talk about it. This is a part of the Apocrypha, as I just mentioned. It's part of this new commentary that with the Jewish Annotated Apocrypha. And we have on the 11th episode of the show, we did have Professor Karen Tamber Rosenau talk about wine in the Book of Judith. So this is actually the second book in the Apocrypha to be discussed on the show. Although, Professor Satlow, what, for some context, what is the Book of Ben Sira, and where does that play into Jewish literature throughout the ages?
Yeah, so maybe I should just take a step back and start with the Apocrypha, right? So the Apocrypha,
yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
Right, for those of you, I guess, who haven't heard the episode on Judith, but the Apocrypha is a collection of originally Jewish books that apparently, mostly it appears, not entirely, but mostly have been written originally in Hebrew, translated into Greek, and then the underlying Hebrew for the most of them have been lost. Those books were not preserved by and large, and we'll get to the one exception, by Jews, but in fact were preserved by Christians. They made it into a section of the Bible that is considered to be holy or kind of quasi-holy by different denominations of Christians. Mm-hmm. So you'll find the Apocrypha, for example, in Catholic Bibles, but not in every Protestant Bibles, although you'll find it in some Protestant Bibles. Mm-hmm. But again, for Jews, they had very little kind of afterlife, at least that we know of. So the one major exception to that general set of general statements is Ben Sira. Ben Sira, we do have some of the underlying Hebrew, in fact, quite a bit of the underlying Hebrew text, or at least some other version in Hebrew that's very similar to the Greek text that we found in the Cairo Geniza. Moreover, Ben Sira, as you mentioned, Rabbi Kaplan, is in fact quoted by the rabbis. Not quite a scripture, but Ben Sira is in fact quoted as some kind of authority for certain kinds of statements. And those quotations occur both in the Babylonian Talmud and in the Palestinian Talmud.
Yeah.
So now, what's the Book of Ben Sira? So Ben Sira gets its name in the apocryphal books. It's Sirach. Is Jesus, Yeshua Ben Sira. Mm-hmm. The book that we have in the Apocrypha is also prefaced by a short prologue by his grandson, who translated the book into Greek. Ben Sira himself seems to have been a kind of scribe and wisdom teacher who lived in about 180 BCE. Hmm. We know that because he lavishly praises the high priest, Simon, toward the end of his book, who lived around that time. So we think he lived about 180 BCE. The actual translation by his grandson into Greek, his grandson tells us, was made in 132 BCE. Hmm. So he's a wisdom teacher, and it's very interesting, I think, to compare the Book of Ben Sira, which is about 50 chapters. It's full of, things you would find in the Book of Proverbs, for example, these kinds of little sayings, and some of them are kind of deeper truths, and some of them are not. Some of them seem to reflect his social situation, quite a few of them, and I think those are the ones we'll mainly be talking about today. But Ben Sira seems to have been kind of part of a larger cohort of scribes and courtiers within whatever kind of larger group of bureaucracy or authority existed in Jerusalem. He has a mixed opinion of that group. To some extent, he thinks that, you know, these are, you have to be learned to be wise. But on the other hand, these are a bunch of backstabbers who he doesn't fully trust. And he says you shouldn't trust either. And he gives you all kinds of advice about table manners and other kinds of manners so that you can survive within this beehive of treachery. So that is that's kind of an interesting juxtaposition within Ben Sira. And it's very interesting to compare him to Qohelet or Ecclesiastes, which is, of course, is part of the Tanakh. Because on the one hand, you know, Qohelet becomes authoritative for Jews. On the other hand, Ben Sira is much more pious. If you look at Ben Sira, he actually like believes in the Torah and that there was revelation and that this is actually encompasses all of wisdom. Whereas Qohelet or Ecclesiastes is much more a, you know, you live once, you may as well party it up, but try to control yourself kind of guy. So when you compare Ecclesiastes. Yeah, Qohelet is like
that. Interesting. So by the way, just a quick plug for everybody out there. The third episode we dealt with drinking in the book of Ecclesiastes. So if you're interested in more, you can check out that episode also.
The comparison is really interesting because I actually think that Sira knew Ecclesiastes and was responding to him in various ways. Ecclesiastes is very much a, you know, it comes back to certain kinds of Hellenistic philosophies, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. He does have this afterlife in some manuscripts, Hebrew manuscripts, again, as I mentioned, that were found in the Cairo Geniza. But after that, he kind of disappears too. There is no real afterlife of Ben Sira within Jewish traditional texts post the early Middle Ages. So he gets lost, and the finding those fragments, and we found other little fragments also among the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we knew it was an early text in Hebrew that had been carried along. Yeah, just one of those texts that get lost. And it makes you kind of wonder about the texts that got lost for which we don't have any evidence, of which we assume there are many, many such texts that Jews in antiquity read. But they just don't survive.
In this newly published Apocrypha commentary, so you offered a commentary. Where's the translation from?
The translation is actually taken from the New Revised Standard Version. So it's the, you know, Protestant translation, and it has originally, well, scholarly / Protestant. It's published by Oxford University Press. So it's like their other study Bibles. Kind of follows along with the same translation. The book itself is interesting because, as I mentioned before, the apocryphal books got very little play in later Jewish tradition. And to some extent, this is an attempt to reclaim those books as Jewish books. So the commentary, there are many different commentaries, of course, on Ben Sira and on all the apocryphal books. And they all have their own angle. My charge for my commentary and for all the other commentators in the volume was to try to understand this as a Jewish book, specifically within the Jewish tradition, correlating it with other kinds of, especially rabbinic.
I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. I'm very excited to let you know the next three episodes, all in the lead up to Purim, will be, you guessed it, about Purim. Just like we had last year, three episodes leading up to Purim, this year as well. And stay tuned, later on this episode, I'll give you a sneak peek into next week's episode.
As a little bit of an introduction of wine here in this book, it actually appears numerous times throughout the book. And there's actually a concentrated chunk at the end of the 31st chapter with a little bit of a discussion around a banquet at the beginning of chapter 32. And there's also other scattered references to wine throughout the book. When I hear the word banquet, I don't think it really does a lot as far as a direct verbal resonance to drinking. Although I think there is something to be said about, there's a lot of wine, a lot of drinking. But clearly, this, the beginning of chapter 32, this concentrated discussion on banquets clearly has drinking in mind of what's occurring, what's taking place. In the book of Ben Sira, wine is put forth not only as a good, but even as a necessity.
Yes.
So we see this in both chapters 31 as well as 39. So I actually, if it's all right with you, want to focus here on the verses 27 and 28 in the 31st chapter. And this is really a significant starting point, I think. And we have here in the translation from this new volume that came out, I'm just going to read it out for those who don't have it, is wine is very life to human beings if taken in moderation. What is life to one who is without wine? It has been created to make people happy. That there's like a reason that it needed to be created. Wine drunk at the proper time and in moderation. You can't go a line without saying it needs to be moderated. His rejoicing of heart and gladness of soul. So there's this happy aspect. Of course, then he then tempers it in the very next line, which we'll get to. But I find this really fascinating. He says, it's a good in moderation. It's a good in moderation. It brings a lot of happiness in moderation. So he's quick to temper that. So it's not an unqualified good.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. So there's the famous line, of course, wine makes the heart glad.
Yayi samach levav anosh. He is following in the biblical wisdom tradition in saying how much it brings joy to life, to human life. It's not a specifically Jewish thing, but to human life. And although he tempers it, whereas the book of Psalms and the book of Ecclesiastes does not offer any qualification, he immediately does in the very same line, in two lines in a row.
Right, and of course he's gonna harp on that point for a little bit too.
He does say what is life without wine, and he actually goes a little further. I would like to connect these in verses 26 and 27 in the 39th chapter. He enumerates 10 different things that are elements necessary for human life, for a person's life, and wine is it makes the top 10 for Ben Sira.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. So I think whatever conversation needs to happen about wine in the book of Ben Sira, it's a good, it's essential, it should be moderate. He's advising moderation. He doesn't say it needs to be moderated, but it seems to be the path to the best utilization of wine.
Well, that's right. I mean, one could even talk about this more generally, right? So this stands within the kind of, it is a component, although, as you pointed out, a kind of mild component of the wisdom literature, but it's also a very big component of Hellenistic philosophy and the kind of ethos that Ben Sira would have been familiar with in Jerusalem in the second century BCE. Mm-hmm. This idea of moderation. So actually, moderation pervades the book. It's not just wine. And there's another, when one kind of thinks about this theologically as well, and thinks about it, for example, in context of the rabbis. Rabbis do, everything in the world is good because God is good.
Yeah.
So you create everything, but everything also has to be kind of regulated and controlled. And there are limits on how things in the world are to be used and their purpose in life and the purpose in the world. So wine certainly is among them. He's aware that it's an essential for life. It makes you happy. And then of course he gets into kind of, with wine especially, plays an important role in the social life of the community in which he lives.
Yeah. Another thing in going along with the lines of good, as wine as good, he then mentions it in chapter 40, verse 20, as being, there are different manuscript traditions out there. So this is an issue of contention amongst the extant sources. So one views this as wine and music, and one views this as wine and beer. It's Yain v'Sheichar or Yain v'Shir. But either way, both are good. Whether it's wine and music or wine and beer, both are good, but not compared to wisdom, which seems to go back to what you were saying, Professor Sattlow. Wisdom pervades this book, right?
Right.
Right. So they're both good, but in a sense of hierarchy, wisdom trumps. It's just better.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, for him, it's really a qualitative, not a quantitative difference.
Mm.
So, you know, there's wisdom and that's ultimate good. And then there are the enjoyments of life.
Yeah.
And those are different kinds of goods. So they're not really even on the same scale.
You can even think about whether it's wine and music or wine and beer. You could think of them as being more ephemeral, whereas wisdom is more everlasting, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so perhaps that could be an aspect where that is preferable. It's also more actionably preferable. They help guide one's life, whereas these are just mere fleeting aspects of enjoying life.
Right. Now, the music part is actually a kind of, I mean, I think that is an important aspect, and we get that elsewhere in Bensira as well, because right. Wine isn't just, it's not come home from work and sit on your little sofa and have a glass of wine to cool down for the day. For him, wine is also a social activity. It takes place in a communal setting, and that communal setting often has music. Mm-hmm. So yeah. It's all part of a conviviality mm-hmm. Experience.
Right. So in chapter 32, verse 6, he talks about how well wine pairs with music. And as you mentioned, it's part of that banquet context, that conviviality, and whether it was a convivium or a symposium, whatever it was, but certainly having those two combine is, there's like a synergistic aspect to enjoying that wine.
Yeah, I mean, he assumes, I mean, to put this in kind of a little bit flip, but kind of modern terms, he assumes that these are scribal cocktail parties. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be happening. All the scribes get together and, you know, with other members, important members of the court, mm-hmm. And they're going to have, you know, somebody playing the harp in the corner, and they'll be drinking wine. And that wine will be preferably good wine, because and not just the new wine, which is the sweet wine.
Speaking of new wine and old wine, is that he also compares it in verse 10 of chapter 9, that wine is compared to a friend, that it gets better with age. The more time you spend with someone and have that relationship develop. So to wine, when it's fresh, it's new, yeah, it's sweet. It also doesn't have a lot of character, but give it time to age, it will develop and be significantly improved.
That's right. That's right. And he's also, I mean, he talks more about friends than he does about wine through the book. Friends are really very important to him, because there are people who say they're your friends, but they're not your friends. And again, this goes back to this whole context within a kind of a bureaucracy.
And you mentioned at the top of the show about the backstabbing and being careful, right?
That's right. That's right. Those are the people who, like, they claim to be your friends, but they're not. So there he's kind of saying, well, you know, the longer you develop a friendship, the longer you develop trust, this is kind of, and this is typical wisdom literature, stuff that you would think is a little bit intuitive or just comes from living. You learn, whereas, you know, other people, well, you shouldn't really trust them that much.
This is really interesting when it comes to chapter 31, verse 31, which is, do not reprove your neighbor at a banquet of wine, probably a mishte yayin in Hebrew, and nor despise him in his merrymaking, and speak no word of reproach to him, and do not distress him by making demands of him. So I don't know how much this is necessarily within, of course, these things are within the context of a banquet, of a wine drinking session or a wine drinking party, but I also wonder, just stumbling upon a friend who's drinking, and whether it's reproving your neighbor, despising them, all these things. And this reproving and despising has echoes of Leviticus 19, of reproving and not hating one's fellow in their heart, but rather reproving them. So that's from Leviticus chapter 19. So that's a little bit of an echo there, but just saying you should think about it and have a little bit of wisdom around the timing and the contextuality of this reproving and not hating your fellow. I think sometimes we can see someone who's enjoying themselves, they're having a great time, they're loving it, and it could seem that in someone's heart, bothered by one's friend, why are you enjoying yourself so much? Didn't you know you wronged me or you did something? And it just seems, even though that's the right action, it's a terribly inappropriate timing and context.
Yeah, I think for Bensira, this is all about context. It's all about, you're here at this banquet. Let's again go back to a business cocktail party, mm-hmm. and you have wine flowing and people's inhibitions are down.
Yeah.
And bad things can happen. So Ben Sira is here trying to give a kind of moderating perspective. Not only should you not get too drunk, you know, have a glass or two, enjoy it, but don't do more than that. But so you don't get all out of control, but you know, you'll be, other people will be going out of control. And you have to kind of know how to deal with that as well in a way that makes sense within that social context.
So sticking along the lines of banqueting, we also have still within chapter 31, we have verses 25 and 26, which again, go to more of this sort of concern that it's not all just a great time, but that there should be some concern to exercise or some care and caution.
I hope you've been enjoying this episode so far. And here is a sneak peek into next week's episode featuring Professor Vadim Putsu speaking about an early Kabbalistic take on drinking on Purim.
Vital, like a lot of Kabbalists before him, tends to attribute a symbolic value to wine. He views wine as a sort of a material, earthly, if you will, embodiment, representation of one of the ten sfirot, one of the aspects of the divine manifestation in the universe.
I hope you enjoyed that sneak peek to next week's episode. Now back to this episode with Professor Michael Satlow.
We have in verses 25 and 26, this is really interesting. Do not try to prove your strength by drinking wine, for wine has destroyed many. As the furnace tests the work of the smith, so wine tests hearts when the insolent quarrel. So this could go in different directions, because on the one hand, it's interesting. When I think about the second part of verse 25, wine destroying many, that almost sounds more of like a long-term thing. Whereas trying to prove one's strength by drinking wine, it seems to be a particular moment in time, almost like a contest, which are two different things, although both nevertheless still true. I do appreciate your commentary here, which was, like today, some in antiquity believed that excessive drinking was a sign of masculine strength, it's more than just arm wrestling. It's
wine pong.
Yes. Seeing how much one can stand up to this, which is really fascinating. It's like a contest here, but he almost says, don't try to get into such contests. It doesn't help anybody. Getting into such contests doesn't really help anybody.
Right. And I think actually you're right that there are really, this is working on two levels. I mean, one is the kind of really immediate moment contextual level. Like, you know, you start getting involved in out drinking your colleagues, and then you will say something or do something that you will really come to regret. That will be your downfall, that somebody will use against you in that context. But then there's something much kind of broader going on, which is the idea of self-control. Mm-hmm. And this connect to that broader theme in Ben Sira. So again, if you lose, overly drinking too much is losing self-control. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like sleeping with too many people, which he kind of makes, he's going to start making that equivalency too. Mm-hmm. And that kind of loss of self-control, that is a downfall in itself. So it's a character downfall, or a tragic flaw, if you will, in a human being. So that's why one has to be really careful.
Right. And I find it really fascinating that he sandwiches this on the front end. Then he has those two verses that we mentioned earlier about wine being good, wine being sort of an essential aspect of someone's enjoying of life, tempered by moderation, of course. And then on the back end, then sandwiching it with verse 29, which is wine drunk to excess leads to bitterness of spirit, to quarrels, and to stumbling. And I don't think this needs any explanation. I think this is this is evident for anybody who's ever seen anybody.
Correct.
This is the most straightforward, simple, everlasting truth with regards to wine. It also provides an explanation as to why in the previous two verses he makes sure he inserts in moderation, because of these things that people, you know, could stumble upon.
Right.
I think that's one of the most fascinating insights of aspects of this book, of studying it, of reading it, of seeing how evergreen these are. Sure, there's a lot of, as you mentioned, very particular social context of what he's dealing with in the Jerusalem bureaucracy in the early second century BCE. And yet at the same time, they're nevertheless evergreen, everlasting human concerns.
Some are, for sure. But I mean, at other parts, like when we get to women, no. Here, Ben Sira is very much a product of his age, which is not our age.
Right. So it's not 100%. It's moderation. It's not 100% one thing or the other. It's moderation. And also, speaking of moderation, he, at the very end of chapter 18 and the first verse of chapter 19, he says, don't be a zolel or sova, the nothing will be in your pocket, and this worker will not become rich. That if someone, and this channels I want to say the Ben Sora or Mora, this rebellious child in the book of Numbers?
Deuteronomy.
I stand corrected. This rebellious child who is, as the rabbis later understand it, he's a glutton for meat and he just drinks so much wine. And so someone who's, they're becoming a lot of wine. And here with the worker, it almost sounds like it's a foolish expenditure of money on the meat and the wine. In comparison with this rebellious son of who's just such a glutton, having so much meat, having so much wine, a glutton and a drunkard. And here too, that even, especially for a worker, maybe, you know, thinking along socioeconomic lines, maybe it's okay if you have the means to afford it. But if you're really just spending all your income just on these fleeting enjoyments of life, and perhaps even overdoing it as a glutton and as a drunkard, it's not going to work out well for this person.
Right.
And I think this is also, and then the very next verse in chapter 19 is wine and women make men of understanding stand aloof. So it's interesting that wine and women are now being brought together, but also even men of understanding, that someone who has a good mind about them, yet wine can make them, lose out in life.
Yeah, and again, I think there too, it's beginning to get at these two different levels. So one level is that, well, you know, when you drink, you lose some self-control and you do things with love interests that you might not otherwise do. Right. That's on the local contextual level. But then there's the larger level, right? The kind of more, you know, level of character, where when you start drinking too much, you're having too much sex, you're just not controlling yourself.
Although in 19.2, it seems to be that they're two separate issues, that women can make men and also wine can make men, that they're not connected.
Yeah, right. I mean, they are and they are, right? So you can
right. They're play both
off in different directions. But I think Ben Sira does have a pretty good idea of the kind of person he doesn't like, the kind of person you shouldn't be, mm-hmm. right? And that is a person who can't exercise control over your bodily desires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is not the only time he puts wine and women together. He, in fact, the very first mention of wine in the entirety of the book of Ben Sira is chapter 9, verse 9, is not getting drunk with a married woman. He just straight out says it, don't get drunk with a married woman, almost as if to say, literally nothing good can come out of this.
Right. No, I think that's right.
You're just asking for trouble. Yeah, that's also pretty straightforward. That doesn't really need a lot of explanation.
Yep. But also, you know, it's interesting here. It connects to his view of women generally, mm-hmm. right? That women are, they're problems for men. That's how we conceive. This book is written for men. Mm-hmm. That is the implied audience of the book, or the kind of quasi-aristocratic man. Mm-hmm. And here you have the problem are... You're the man that is the reader, your wife, she can always go off and sleep with somebody else and that would reflect terribly on you. Your mm-hmm. daughter, she can go off and sleep with somebody else and that would reflect terribly on you.
So this is the worry. Men always worry about women.
Yeah. So it's a great source of anxiety for Ben Sira, mm-hmm. which is where he is very much a man of his time. And sometimes he's been called kind of misogynistic. I think that's probably a little bit strong. For terming him, but you know, he has this just general anxiety that's part of the age, mm-hmm. when it, at least in, as it's reflected in the literature, that these men in antiquity, you know, understand women as a kind of battlefield through which their honor is won and lost, but mainly lost.
Wow.
So that there too, you know, you do have that going on at the same time as this whole thing with the wine. And when you put the two together, that's just like really bad news.
That's really asking for it. And speaking of which, we have one further wine and women verse, which is in chapter 26, verse 8, that a drunken woman gets very angry and doesn't even cover up her own shame, which I feel is almost a little bit of a euphemism, the shame aspect.
I think that you know, goes on this general ancient attitude mm-hmm. that women in general have a hard time keeping control, and you put wine in them and they have an even harder time keeping control. Mm. So, you know, there's this kind of very androcentric understanding that women need to be, for their own sake, to be kind of controlled and by not letting them get drunk, by keeping wine away from them, because again, nothing good comes of too much wine for anybody, men or women. But for women, the bar is lower. And that, you know, they will also be kind of sexually propositioning with just a drink or two.
It's what you mentioned, this deep concern of worry about women intersecting with this looseness that comes with wine and the dangers inherent. That it's just the mixture of two not good things coming together. Not necessarily bad things. I mean, women have both women and wine, and from an androcentric perspective, have good aspects. And yet at the same time, there are concerns. And so to see that intersection is anxiety provoking for him.
Right. And it's anxiety provoking too, because it's being kind of played out in a public context in which honor and shame are very important. And honor and shame end up being a kind of zero-sum game. I get honor on your shame. Mm. So if you are constantly part of this, and I think that many of us probably recognize that kind of dynamic in some way from our work environments or other kinds of environments in which we function. And that, you know, there's a fear of being shamed in public. And certain kinds of behaviors can bring that shame on you. Certain kinds of ways other people treat you can bring that shame on you. For Ben Sira, the way the women who are supposed to be under your control act brings that shame on you too.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, Ben Sira is a pretty conventional, and as you pointed out, an evergreen kind of perspective on wine and drinking, you know, which is good to have a couple of glasses here and there. Works in a social context, be careful. It can be really dangerous.
Right. Yeah. He's very worried about someone getting carried away. It almost sounds like he sees this all the time, that yes, the moderation pieces are there, but the only reason he has to really keep mentioning not only the moderation, but the dangers of not moderation is because he sees it going on around all the time, and that he needs to say that action and that action. You know what, let's dial it back. Let's reel it in.
Right. But he's saying that also about everything at these banquets. So, you know, when you see the larger context, and I advise, you know, your listeners to go and kind of take a look, because his whole, you know, really long, kinds of talks about table manners in general, you know, not chewing with your mouth open, not eating too much, being careful about wiping your mouth. I mean, all these different kinds of things, like how you're supposed to behave at these banquets. Mm. Because again, you mess up, and it's potentially a matter of shaming and a loss of honor.
That's definitely helpful to think about the broader context about consumptive activities.
Exactly.
Yeah. So thank you for those insights around wine. Are there broader insights that really, you know, throughout providing the commentary for this new volume that came out, were there any particular surprises or just, you know, really fascinating things for you in the course of this work?
I've never done a commentary before. So I've written many other things, but not a commentary. So this was really kind of interesting for me to kind of move through and to try to read the book with the context of, really having to like understand every verse and trying to make it accessible, and to make it accessible, especially for a Jewish audience, specifically, or as a Jewish book, even to a Christian audience. So that was a really interesting experience for me. I wish I could say that I ended after spending several years with now my friend Ben Sira. I ended up liking him less.
Really? How so?
What? An individual. So you think about it, this somebody you want to have at your dinner table, right? I mean, you get to know the guy intimately, at least only from the writing. There's one little piece of him. The book itself it certainly has these great, moments, beautiful different pieces, really solid, interesting advice. But it's a little bit disorganized. His attitude toward women is just nothing. And he has these other kind of dispositions that are a little bit distasteful. So it's a kind of interesting thing to engage him from a kind of modern perspective as well. You can see him and have understanding from him as a person of his age.
I do have one final question for you, which was, what was it like coming from a background of rabbinic literature and approaching this text? It does get, as you mentioned, it does get mentions in both the Babylonian and the Palestinian Talmuds. How was it for you to bring your rabbinic literature scholar lens to this book?
It was very interesting. So there's some things really resonated very well. They just boom. You know that the Talmudic passage that kind of correlates with it. Kind of pops into your head right away. So you could see that. There is a kind of general connection, but I would emphasize the general part of that connection because, in that time period, so the rabbis are living some 300 years or so after Ben Sira. But the whole place is infused with a kind of Hellenism, the certain kinds of very conventional ways of thinking, and that you see some kind of carryover over the course of this time is to be expected, but is also interesting. And it's also interesting, for me, it's always more interesting to some extent where they diverge, Ben Sira is not actually reflecting, he's going off with something that is just less, you see much less of in the rabbis.
Professor Salo, this was really fantastic. And I want to thank you so much for spending your time and sharing your wisdom.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, fantastic. And L'chaim.
L'chaim.